How about this? Better? Okay, I really don't like standing here, but I guess I'll have to today. Okay, well, still welcome to the third lecture. Two comments at the very beginning. Some of you have been wondering where this library assignment has been, right? Just before I wanted to upload it, I got an email from my colleague in literature, Professor Dannenberg, who asked me to actually hold off, if possible, so that there wouldn't be any overlap with her library assignment, which apparently you've been doing for the past, I don't know, last week or something like that. That's why I kept this away from you. It will be uploaded very soon. Again, I don't want to do it today because of the people who can't listen to the lecture. You will all be alerted by email also about the existence of the uploaded assignment, so you won't miss it, unless of course you don't check your email, but we've been through that. Okay. There was another thing I wanted to let you know. Yeah, the other thing is that I have been told that two or three people have been having trouble with the online lectures. On the one hand, I know that the quality is still not as good as it could be, and I've been working on that. Last year, it was a lot better. I'm not quite sure which settings I have messed with, I guess. I'll be working on it, and if I can make those slides available or the video available in a better quality, I will do so. Can I ask for a show of hands again for those? Is there anyone who has not been able to get to, I mean, to watch whatever is online? Okay, so it must... Oh, you. Okay. Because... I mean, one option is that you need to have QuickTime installed on your computer, but, I mean, we can talk about that after the lecture, all right? Good. I'd like to say a few more things about last week's lecture, and I'd like to... Because I know that some of you were worried, because it was a lot, okay? And it was difficult to know which elements would be, well, worthy to learn in the sense of required for the exam and which ones not. And I thought I'd let you know now what is going to be on the, well, I call it no list, which is, well, it's not an official word, I guess, but it's the list of no worthy items or keywords for the lecture that I will distribute again at the end of the lecture. At the moment, it says this. For human-animal communication, I would really want you to be able to talk about and use the six terms that I introduced in the last lecture. And I have the term... Okay, maybe you don't see this too well. This is not in boldface, onomatopoeia, so that it is less important in the sense of active knowledge and being able to write about it than the other six terms, or than the six terms. And anything in spelling, really, is in brackets, which means nice to know, but no need to know for the exam. Okay? So you do not, as I said already last week in the lecture, you do not need to learn the spelling rules by heart, etc. It is background for your linguistic general knowledge, but it is not something that you need to be concerned about learning by heart. Okay. If there is something that you don't understand about it, then it's still worth asking and still worth looking into it, but it's not something that you need to sort of memorize. Okay. And then these three terms, or rather the two subterms relating to the prescriptive versus descriptive approach, are again not boldface, but I would sort of expect passive knowledge of this, and if faced by an exam question, some kind of basic understanding of the comments, but there will not be a major question about this. Just to give you an idea of the kind of question we asked last time, it's a mixture of questions. One type of question is a sort of more like a definition question, and the other one is where you will have to write a short essay. The exact length is still to be determined. In one of the exams last year, we asked the question, evaluate the claim that human and animal communication are in fact very similar. Okay. And you would then have to be in a situation where you can say what is similar and what is not similar, where the clear-cut differences are, which elements are clearly for human valid or relevant for human communication alone, and which ones are actually shared with the animal world. Okay? Now, I hope this has sort of helped you a little bit to find out what will be expected of you. I hope to make those kind of comments throughout the year. If you're uncertain about the year, the lecture course, if you're uncertain about something, just sort of write to me, ask the tutorial teachers, come into my office hour, etc. Okay? Right, today's lecture, you'll get a lot, and I really mean a lot of new vocabulary today. Okay, I'll throw a lot of terminology at you today, and much of that, I'm afraid, and this is more so than in other lectures, I think, much of that is actually something that you will have to have active knowledge of. Okay, we will be looking at the sounds of English. It's the first of two lectures, as you saw on the outline, on phonetics and phonology, and we will be concerned with the sounds of English and how they are produced and how we represent them in writing in a system. I will introduce you to the International Phonetic Alphabet, which is used to transcribe these sounds. In the exam, because I know you're concerned about the exam, you will not be asked to actively transcribe yourself. But you will have to, and you can absolutely, I mean, you can expect a question like that. I'll give you a symbol that, I mean, one of the IPA symbols that I'm going to introduce you today, and you have to describe it. Okay, this is going to be one of the questions. Okay. Now, I already mentioned this in the introductory lecture, I think, namely that Finnegan's system and the reading that you've done for today is actually slightly different from what I'm going to present you with today. Okay. Now, this is on the one hand confusing, on the other hand it's something that you will be seeing and meeting again throughout your career in linguistics. There are just different ways of doing linguistics and different conventions and different terms that people use for the same thing, etc., etc. Okay. Now, Finnegan uses a way of annotating or a way of transcribing which is very common in American textbooks. Okay. That has advantages, it has disadvantages. We decided that it's going to be better to expose you to the, let's call it, fully professional set of symbols available for transcription, which is given by the International Phonetic Alphabet. I will point out a few differences, but I would like you to know about this at the very beginning, and I hope you can handle that. Okay. Right. First, a quick quote about speech. The most highly skilled muscular activity that human beings ever achieve. Okay, that's quite a claim. So it must be something rather complex, something rather elaborate that we're talking about. But let's start at the very beginning. What is sound? Okay. Now, this is not a lecture in physics, but it probably is known to you that sound is some kind of energy, some form of energy. Okay. It is air that vibrates, or it's the particles in the air that vibrate, and that basically move in waves because one particle sort of pushes the next one, and that continues until the energy is lost. Okay? And if the energy isn't lost before the eardrum, before it touches the eardrum, then the eardrum in our heads will notice it, will pick it up, and we'll try to make sense of it. Well, our brain makes sense of it. Okay. That's basically what happens when we listen and when we understand speech, or understand the sounds of speech. Okay. And whatever sound it is really depends on, well, how it vibrates in a way, okay? How the air particles vibrate. Okay. And this is influenced by the shape around which they vibrate. Okay? The size of certain aspects in my body will have an influence on the nature of the sounds that I can or will produce. Many of you will have, well, I call it the bottle experiment. Many of you will have filled bottles with different amounts of water and then sort of produced some sound by blowing on over the edge of the opening. And then, of course, depending on how much water is in there, whether there is less air that's left in the bottle, there will be a different sound that's coming out of it. And that's sort of the general principle also, to some extent, in our vocal tract. Okay. I suspect many of you, if not most or all, will have been to the dentist. What does the dentist say? Please say E, right? No? Why not? Because if he says, or she says, ah, then you open your mouth, and that obviously makes the point that there is a correlation between the between certain aspects of how the tongue is, or where the tongue is in your mouth, how open your mouth is, the form of your lips, etc. That has an immediate effect on what sound comes out of your mouth. Okay? And of course, for the dentist, it's much more attractive to have an open mouth to work with in most circumstances. Okay. Right. I would like to look at these individual aspects of the human vocal tract in a bit more detail, and that's where I will be introducing a lot of new terminology. Well, that's the first aspect of the lecture where I will be introducing a lot of new terminology, and much of this will also be available, of course, in Finnegan as well. Now, this is what we're talking about. Don't need to say what this is, a human head, but this bit here has a number of little arrows, and I would like to put labels on those and say a few things about how they connect with the sounds that we produce when we speak. Okay. And I'd like to start with the lips. In a way, possibly a trivial point, but something that can be very important. When we move the lips, then of course we move the jaw, but only the lower lips move, right? The upper lips stay stationary. Small detail, but the lower lip moves upwards and downwards, while the upper lip is non-mobile. Okay. This is of course also the case for the teeth, okay, because of the way our jaw functions. Upper teeth are non-mobile, only the front teeth are in fact used in speech production. Okay. There are no sounds that involve the sort of back teeth. Okay. Right, the next term is possibly the first more technical one today, and that's the alveolar ridge. Okay. If you try to put the tip of your tongue just behind the, in the front of your mouth, behind the top teeth, and then move back a little bit, then you'll get some kind of bump. Okay, and this bump is the alveolar ridge. So I mean, you can try. I'll always give you time to try this out. Okay. I'll also ask you to produce a couple of sounds today. You don't have to feel embarrassed about this. Okay. You can really try this out. So you don't need to make a sound to find out where the alveolar ridge is, though. Okay. The next element is the heart palate. Okay. That's when you use your tongue to move backwards. That's this sort of plateau-like element or part in your mouth, which is behind the alveolar ridge. Okay, and it's hard. There is a bone there. Okay. And then, if you move back further with your tongue, you reach a place where the bone basically disappears and it becomes soft. Okay, that's called the velum, which is, as it says here, a patch of soft tissue. Now, because it is soft and because it is, well, basically related or close to the palate, or it's basically the same part of the mouth, just not hard, it's sometimes called the soft palate. Okay. Then back down here, we've got this cone-shaped pendulum, okay, which is at the almost in your throat already. It's at the back of the velum. And it stops bits of food going up the nose when you swallow. Okay. And it can also have an influence on what kind of sounds you produce. Okay. Right. Then we've got your throat. Okay. The technical term for throat is pharynx. Okay, for sort of this bit here. Okay. Oh, by the way, the velum here acts as a valve-like sort of feature to control the flow of air into the nasal cavity. Okay. If it's lowered, then the air is free to go into the nasal cavity. If not, then the air has to go through the mouth. Okay. And, well, I've just mentioned nasal cavity. We've got the oral cavity and the nasal cavity. So that's the nasal one, and that's the oral one. Makes sense. Okay. Right. As I said, it's called the pharynx. There is also another word with ending in inx, okay, which is down here, which is the larynx. And if you're male, then you may know this as the Adam's apple. Well, you may know this if you're female as well, but, I mean, you will actually have it. Okay? It's more protruded in males than in female. Yeah. Now, what I like to say in this context, that if you play Scrabble, you now have two extra words to play when you have an X and the Y, right? So, yes, now you know. Okay. And then, and this is, of course, very important, down here, we have the vocal cords, okay, or sometimes called vocal folds. Okay. And they are the ones who... my vocal cords are acting up, sorry. They are the ones which vibrate and which create the sound. They do this by opening and closing. Okay. And in fact, what the place where they're found is called the glottis. Okay. So, this down here is the glottis, and that's where the vocal cords or vocal folds are found, and they're important for making a sound voiced or voiceless. But I'm already going ahead. And then, of course, we have the tongue. And the tongue has several parts. Tip of the tongue. Okay, you can say that something is on the tip of your tongue, but the front, obviously. But the whole front itself has sort of the name front, but not the very tip. Then we've got the center, we've got the back, and we've got the root. And I haven't actually indicated those in the graph, because I think it's quite obvious what we're talking about. There is also something here which I haven't named, which is called the epiglottis, which is quite important when you want to swallow food and make sure that it doesn't go into the wrong way. But it doesn't actually have any influence, as far as I'm aware of, in terms of which sounds you produce. Now, all of this, and that's why it's rather complex, cooperates to produce sounds when we speak. Okay. All of the different elements in some way form one part of what finally comes out of your mouth. In addition to that, of course, we need air. Okay. We need air that comes from your lungs, and that's why it's called pulmonic or pulmonic airstream, which is involved. Okay. In fact, and this is a term which you do not necessarily have to know, it is egressive air. What does that mean? Well, the opposite is ingressive. You don't inhale when you produce. I now exhale when I produce a sound. I do not. If I go like this, it's much more difficult to actually produce a sound. Okay. And all the sounds produced in English are based on egressive airstream. Okay, so the stream, this airstream first hits the larynx and the vocal cords. So let's have a look at that. I already mentioned voicing as a concept, meaning that there is a sound. Well, there's a special kind of sound, of course. A voiceless sound is also a sound, but it's got to do with whether your vocal cords vibrate. This depends also on the size of the glottis. If it is open, the air can pass freely. If it is narrow, then because it is narrow, the airflow will actually cause the vocal folds to vibrate, and that then produces sounds. Now, here's one thing that you can actively try out yourself. What's wrong with me today? This is fitting that it's in a lecture on phonetics and sounds, of course, but... Right. If you produce those red elements, you can do this now if you want. She, not the E, of course, but just the first sounds. So, sh, and th. And if you put your hand onto your throat while you do this, then you won't actually feel much, right? But if you then say, ah, okay, then you can actually literally feel your throat vibrate. Okay. Yeah. So this is a practical demonstration of the difference between a voiced and a voiceless sound. Okay. And in fact, when you speak, like what I'm doing right now, and then you will constantly feel the vibration coming to go on and off. Okay. Yeah. I'll give you 20 seconds to talk to your neighbor to try this out if you want. Okay. Now there's another term. Please stop vibrating now. Okay. There's a term that's called pitch. The speed of the vibration, okay, has an effect on the sound that is produced, of course, and that's the reason also why because the male larynx is larger than that of female speakers, okay, typically male voices will be lower. Here's another thing we could try out. Can you hum a tune and whisper at the same time? No, right? You can't do that. Yeah? You can't. That's because whispering and humming are not compatible. Okay. One is voiced, the other one is voiceless. Okay, I'd like to, before I actually go through all the consonants and all the vowels in a bit more detail, and that's what we're going to do for a while in this lecture, I would like to show you what actually happens inside a mouth when we do this, when we speak. Okay? And I found a few very nice old videos that were done with x-rays at a time when this was still possible, I guess. Nowadays you would use MRIs or MRTs or something like that. But I would like you to have a look at what happens from a very physical point of view when we speak. And I'm going to put the... make it very dark now because I think you'll see it much better, so it'll become brighter again in a minute. But okay, let's see.
On top of his deck.
At the end, the person says deck. Have a look at where the tongue is positioned. Yeah? Pretty much back and up, and it touches a particular point in your mouth, okay, or in that person's mouth. Also look at the lips on top of p. The two lips actually, of course, come together, and then they release the air in what we will call a plosive.
On top of his deck.
Right. Here's another one. Here's another one. Now the person will say three words in close succession, and you will see that something changes quite dramatically in terms of the position of the tongue.
Ha ha ha. a ta, a car, a pa, a ta, a car, a pa, a ta, a car, a pa.
Okay. Right. Oops. Okay. So I hope this will make what I'm the sort of more theoretical bits a little bit more real for the rest of the lecture. Okay. The source of the videos has actually disappeared. It used to be there, but the website doesn't exist anymore. It was from Peter Ladefoged's course in phonetics. Okay. Okay. When we talk about sounds that are being produced, then both place and manner are important aspects, namely place of articulation and manner of articulation. Okay. And we've seen hpa, hta, hka, and the difference is basically, partly in any case, the position of the tongue. Okay. And with a p, we've got, the lips involved as well. Okay. Then hfa, hsa, hch, well, whatever, ha, we've got, rather than having the airflow completely stop for a moment, we've got air flowing through something that is actually becoming more narrow, and therefore we get a different sound. Okay. And then we can have it with or without voicing. So the difference between hpa and hba is not the place and the manner of articulation, but it's voicing. Okay. And as you can see, hva, I can say, hza, hra, how do you put this into writing? You can already see that the spelling system, and that's one of the reasons why I introduced spelling last time, of English does not account for all the sounds that we can make. Okay. And certainly not when other languages are involved. And that's where the IPA comes in. IPA, yes, short for International Phonetic Alphabet. Also, for the beer drinkers or ale drinkers among you, it's India Pale Ale, but today it's International Phonetic Alphabet. System of phonetic annotation or notation. It was actually based on the Latin alphabet. It is more than 100 years old, and it has gone through many revisions, and the last one, as far as I know, 5 years ago. If you want to read more about this, then here is a link to the IPA website. The International Phonetic Alphabet. Right, now I'm going to speed through the different consonants and the different vowels, and I'm going to start with the consonants. And I'm going to look at place of articulation, manner of articulation, etc. One way of producing a consonant is to have a bilabial consonant. Bilabial meaning both lips are involved. The sound is the p, for example, okay, as in pop, and the symbol used in the IPA is the P within the square brackets. Okay. I'll say more about the brackets later on. We can have a labiodental sound, one lip, and the teeth. Okay. So something like fish, where the lower lip is put against your upper teeth and produces. We can have dental or interdental place of articulation. Something like bath, where the tongue is placed between the teeth, the TH. We can have an alveolar consonant, as for example in top or C. The difference, of course, being that in the first case the air is stopped completely, and in the second one the air produces some friction. Okay. Okay. You can always try this out yourself if it helps. Then there is the post-alveolar or alveopalatal or palato-alveolar. I've given you all terms that you will find in the literature, consonant as exemplified by sh, as in ship. Okay, sh. If you look at where the tongue is positioned, then it's slightly further back. There is the palatal y, yes. Okay. Sh, yi. If you produce first sh and then yi, then you can see how the tongue actually moves back. Okay. Then there is a velar consonant, as in, for example, k, as in kiss. Okay. And then there is a glottal consonant. Well, okay, I'll come to the glottal stop in a minute. But actually, the H in house is also produced in the glottis. Okay. There are also uvular sounds, but they're not very common in English. Okay. Right, that was place of articulation. Manner of articulation. When we talk about manner, then we refer to the question to what extent the air is obstructed. Completely, partially, not at all, etc. And this is also sometimes in literature referred to as stricture. Okay. You can have full blockage or complete stricture, or you can have partial stricture, or in fact, of course, no stricture. And then some people talk of open approximation, or in the case of partial stricture, of close approximation. Okay. Now let's go through those different manners, again, of course, in the context of consonants. Plosives. Some people call them stops. Okay. And that means that the air can't get through, okay, but then is abruptly released. And sort of, you can think of an explosion or an implosion, I don't know, but it's basically that idea that something abruptly and very quickly is released. We can have bilabial plosives, b and p. Alveolar plosives, t and d, velar plosives, and we can have a glottal plosive, the glottal stop which I just tried to produce, glottal, right? My son, when he went to, well, we lived for a while in northern England, and he did this wonderfully. He would talk about his water bottle. So, down here. Then we've got the affricates. There is also complete stricture, but there is a release which then, in that sense they're similar to the plosives, but the release is not immediate in the sense that with a p, it's either closed at the beginning and then immediately opened. But if you do this more slowly, then you will have a period of friction. And that friction is, for example, found in sounds like ch, ch, where we've got the t, which is first, in a way, a plosive, but then ch, where the air is let through, but there is quite strong stricture, and therefore we produce a sound ch, or j, when it's voiced. Okay, we started from complete closure to something that is partially, at least for part of the sound, open. We're now moving further in that direction. We're looking at fricatives, where we have stricture as well, and no plosives at all, or no complete closure at all. Partial stricture is there. Labiodental fricatives like leaf, the f in leaf, or in fact the voiced versions, version v, as in leave. Okay, leave. Or a dental fricative, three, voiceless, and this, voiced. We can go back in the mouth and say alveolar fricatives, as in s and c and zu. Okay. Post-alveolar fricatives, as in wash or measure. Okay. And we've got the glottal fricative, as in house. Next up on the level of, let's call it openness, are the approximants. And they're made with what's known as open approximation. So the space between the articulators is wide. And that's got, there are a number of those, namely the r, as in the alveolar red. Palatal y, yes. Labiovelar labiovelar w. Now this is one that you don't find in Finnegan. Okay. Why is it called labiovelar? If you can look at this term, then you can see that the lips, as in labial, and velar, the back of your, well, behind the palate, or the soft palate, is involved. And that's what some people call a case of double articulation, where in fact two elements are involved to produce this sound. Okay. This is different from what you can see in Finnegan. And there is another term which, to be honest, I can't now remember whether Finnegan introduces it. That's the lateral, which is also involving something, something additional. Namely, if you look at, if you try out how the L is produced, then the tip of your tongue touches the alveolar ridge, but the sides of the tongue sort of bend downwards and then allow the air to escape. So we have sort of a particular way the tongue has to be shaped in order for this to happen. Okay. Now that glottal fricative shouldn't be there, sorry, because we're no longer talking about fricative. Scratch this. Okay, sorry. Happens when you copy-paste from the previous slide. Okay. Right. Nasals. Nasals are produced with complete oral closure, okay, which means that if there is aggressive pulmonic airstream, it has to go somewhere else, and it'll go through your nose. Okay. And that's because the velum is lowered. Okay. We've got, again, bilabials. A bilabial consonant as in m, as in mat. We've got the alveolar m, where the tongue is on the alveolar ridge. And we've got the velar sing. And I mentioned m as a sound which in English cannot happen or cannot be found at the beginning of a word. Okay. Notice that all of them are voiced. Okay, the nasals are voiced. There are a few more manners, but they are minor manners. There is something that's also mentioned in Finnegan, a tap, or sometimes called a flap, which is, well, I've got another way of calling it here, high velocity short stop. Okay. So the different types of taps, the alveolar tap is in the American pronunciation of city. You know, a British person would say city, but an American, and I can't do this very well, would say something like city, right? City. Or something is muddy, muddy waters, I don't know, muddy. Okay. That's one type of tap. There's also a trill, okay, which is in fact a series of taps in very, very quick succession. An alveolar trill, as in the rolled R, okay? Okay. We've only covered the consonants that are relevant for English. Okay. There are a lot more out there. Okay. And I will upload the IPA chart so that you can have a look at what's there. This will look like this. Okay. Where we have the place, bilabial, labiodental, dental, alveolar, postalveolar, retroflex, etc. Some of the terms I actually didn't introduce. And then we've got the manner. And you can see that for fricatives, in all places of articulation, there are sounds that are produced in languages of the world. This is something that is not just for English, but it's supposed to be applicable for all languages of the world. Okay. Right. Yes, it says here, just to make sure, joke alert. Okay. Some people are trying to get another symbol into the IPA. Okay. What could this be? Well, they say it's a nasal ingressive voiceless velar trill. I'll give you 20 seconds to work this out. Yes? Yes? Yeah? Yes? Okay. In fact, you can buy a t-shirt. Okay. We'll perform nasal ingressive voiceless velar trills for food. I'm a trained linguist. Don't try this at home. Okay. So, yes, this does not exist, but in order to understand it, you have to know the IPA, well, not the IPA, but you have to know the place and the manner of articulation, and you have to know what ingressive is. Right, that was the consonants. Let's move over to the vowels. This requires a different terminology because stricture, the degree of stricture, doesn't apply. Okay. It's useless. Okay. Because all vowels are produced with open approximation. Okay. And also by definition, of course, all vowels are voiced. Okay. Now, the way to describe vowels relates to the shape of the interior of our mouth. Okay. It's called the vowel space. Okay. Now, you've already seen this in the x-ray videos that I showed you, but let's just get you working again with your mouths. Can you produce the vowels found in seat, set, and sat in succession, sort of over and over again? I, e, a, I, e, a. What happens with your... Okay. And do the same for the vowels in seat and soup. Okay. Can you do that without moving your lips? E, u, e, u. No, right? You can't. Okay. Well, basically, that makes another point that I've made, or that makes the point again that I've made before. The position of the tongue determines which vowel is produced. Now, not only the lips are involved as well, but it's the position of the tongue that is very important. And that is actually what is represented in what's sometimes called the vowel trapezium, which looks like this. Okay. And this is supposed to represent the internal part of your, or the inside of your mouth, and the position of the tongue it takes when it produces a particular vowel, or when you produce a particular vowel. So we have a front. We have a center, or something is central, a vowel is central. And we have a back, of course. Mm-hmm. We have something, well, we are high in the mouth, or close. That's because the mouth is closed. That's the dentist example again with E, right? Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have open, ah. Mm-hmm. And we have steps in between, which are usually called close mid, an open mid. Okay. So not quite open, but rather open, and not quite closed, but rather closed. Okay. And the position of the tongue is relevant, no, not is relevant, the position of the tongue within this vowel space determines the sound that is produced. Tongue, okay, can have vertical position, horizontal, well, whether it moves on, well, not the tongue, where in the vertical or in the horizontal part of the vowel space is the tongue located, and also, importantly, whether it moves or not. Okay. There are vowels which involve tongue movement, but we'll first look at the ones that don't. The other important bit, as I've already hinted at, is whether the lips are rounded or unrounded. Okay. Sometimes people call this whether they're rounded or spread. So, okay. Can you produce an exaggerated smile when you say sheep, for example? Sheep. Yes, you can. Can you do the same while saying soup? No, of course not. No? That's because one is rounded and the other one isn't. Okay. That's because there is a connection between your lip, the kind of how you, well, the position of your lips, etc., and the sound. Also, there are long and short vowels, okay, which of course don't depend on the position of anything in your mouth, but basically just whether they're long or short. Okay. Now, don't get a shock, this is what it looks like. This is where the English vowels are located on the vowel space, or in the vowel space. We've got a high or close vowel in front, which is E, as in fleece. Okay. And then we've got, let's say, something down here, calm. Okay. And in fact, you see those two dots, or whatever you want to call it, the colon, which indicates that this is actually a long vowel. And all the vowels that we have in English, remember the question how many vowels we have in English last lecture? You can see that there are quite a few more than five. Okay. Some are there twice like cat, depending on whether it's received pronunciation or not. And also, some of those vowels are actually not present in all Englishes, or even in dialects or regions of England. If anyone's ever been to the north of England, or heard people from the north of England talk, then you will know that one vowel, at least, it doesn't exist for them usually, namely the strut vowel. Okay, they will talk about, not love, they will talk about love. Okay, so it is, this is for sort of southern standard English or received pronunciation. So people talk of the strut vowel and the foot vowel and the nurse vowel because these are the words that are associated with those vowels because they're used in those words. Okay. So far, as I said, the tongue doesn't move. But if it does, well, it, for example, does in words like I or goat or choice, etc. And that's the distinction between monophthongs and diphthongs. Okay. Now, these are the diphthongs relevant for English. Okay. So we have two IPA symbols, but really only one vowel, and what's involved is the movement of the tongue. Okay. So price, face, choice, mouth, goat, near, square, poor, they're the ones relating to this one. Finnegan, and I think there will be a slide later on, Finnegan has different ways of annotation for some of these vowels, but I think there is a slide afterwards. Now, I've forgotten one important vowel. Not forgotten, but I've put it off. And that's if you produce, or if you say those two words, about and letter. Okay? And this is what's called the schwa. This is probably the most frequent vowel in English. Why? Because in unstressed position, virtually everything becomes a schwa. Okay? So it is only, in fact, found in unstressed syllables. Okay? It's in the middle of the vowel space. In the middle. So when you're lazy and you don't move your tongue at all, right? That's the sound. Yes, this is the slide about Finnegan versus IPA. I have to repeat my plea for flexibility in your minds because there is a difference, but as I said, this is quite common anyway. He uses, for example, different symbols for diphthongs. So the IPA version is the first one, and Finnegan uses that one. Okay. The nurse vowel, as in learn or in nurse, okay, is this in IPA, but it's what, well, it's the schwa whatever is the schwa in IPA, okay? So, yes, this is a little bit confusing. Okay. Also, of course, Finnegan applies his system, well, he represents American pronunciation. Okay. So, anyway, I'd like to try this with you now. I'd like you to transcribe the word phonetic. And I'd like you to give a detailed description of each sound. Okay. Based on what maybe you have written down. And if you haven't written it down, don't worry, try. Okay. I don't expect you to get this down 100% or get this correct 100%, but let's do this. And then we'll go through the answer. I'll give you 1.5 minutes, 2 minutes for this. That's the break as well. Okay. Now I know you haven't finished. That's okay. Or if you have, wow. Okay. Right. Now let's look at the individual sounds involved. Keynote does it all for you, don't worry. It's very simple. I try not to have too many flashy things in my... But I couldn't resist here, yes. Anyway, what's F? What's that? Yep. Voiceless, yeah. Labiodental, yeah, okay. Fricative, good, okay. It is a voiceless labiodental fricative. Okay. The lower lip is involved. The teeth are involved. It's voiceless. It's not phonetic. It's phonetic. Okay. And it's a fricative because there is no full stricture at any time. There is no plosive involved. A fricative. What's a? A vowel. Where is it in the vowel space? Is it short or long? It's short. Yeah. What else could we say? What shall I just tell you? Okay. It's mid-centered. It's right in the middle of the vowel space. And the lips are unrounded. You know, you don't have to really do anything. Just say, "uh." Okay. What's N? Yes. Yep. Nasal. Yep. Voiced or voiceless? What did I say about the nasals? They're always voiced. Yeah. So nasal is... it's a voiced nasal. What kind? Place of position? Place of articulation? Watch out. Front is for vowels. Okay. It's an alveolar nasal. Because your tongue is placed on the top of your alveolar ridge. Mm-hmm. The next one is a vowel again. Short or long? Short. Low, mid, front, and rounded. Okay. T, I'm speeding up a little bit. Maybe this will result in a few minutes off earlier again, but sometimes it's difficult to gauge how much time I need. So I'll tell you the answers. T, voiceless alveolar plosive. Okay. And the E sound, short, high, front, and rounded. And the K is in the back. It's produced by letting through the air at all when the tongue touches the velum. So it's a voiceless velar plosive. Right. Now in the exam, as I said, I don't really like to talk about the exam at this stage, but because I know that you want to know anyway. In the exam, you can be absolutely certain of being given either a vowel or a consonant. And you need to describe this. And you should then get not only voiceless and not only labiodental, but you also have to say fricative. So all those elements should be there. Okay. And that, I'm afraid, you really need to learn by heart. Okay, a bit of advice for transcribing. Not that bad. Come on. Okay. Spelling often isn't a good guide. Okay. Also, two letters don't necessarily mean that there are two sounds. Okay. I introduced the digraphs last time, and that's because, well, in writing there was no other way to represent the sound, but that doesn't mean that there are two sounds. I always myself, I mean, I'm not, phonetics and phonology is not my major area. I always have to watch out not to fall into the trap of confusing S and Z in spelling, okay? Because one is voiced, the other one is voiceless. Okay? Now, there are these brackets around. Okay? They indicate that this is a phonetic transcription. Now, you don't need to put them after each or around each symbol. It's okay, as you saw with phonetic, just to do it at the beginning and at the end, and then anyone trained in linguistics will know that this is a phonetic transcription. Also, there's no punctuation in phonetic transcription. Okay. It's a minor point. It's okay if you write it down with your, well, with handwriting. If you want to use a computer, then sometimes people find it difficult because, well, what font do I need, etc. There is a very helpful file online from that's been compiled by one of my colleagues, my former colleagues at Lancaster, Kevin Watson, and this actually describes how you use, well, which font to use and how you insert a particular font, particular symbol into a document, into a Word document. It also says very helpfully at the bottom, if you are having trouble with anything, please contact me, and that's Kevin Watson. Now, I've asked him whether I can show my students his helpful bit of information, but please don't go and contact him. It's for students at Lancaster. If you have any problems with this, contact me rather than Kevin Watson, okay? And he actually refers to something in the files, the hex codes. They can be found here. So, I mean, have a look at those links and this will become clear to you. There is also a really nifty and helpful web page found at this email, this URL, which is actually a way of clicking on the symbol that you want, and it'll then put it into a field at the bottom of the screen from where you can copy-paste it over into your Word document. So this is something that I recommend. Oh yes, here it says what I said. Click on symbols and then copy-paste them into your word processing application. Okay. So that should help you. I've got another thing that might help you, which is a visualization of the place and the manner of articulation. Well, particularly, of course, the place, but as I'll show you in a minute, also the manner of articulation in some ways. It's an interactive chart where you can combine the different elements of the vocal tracts and see what comes out. Okay. Or in what way they can be combined. So here, for example, what do we have? We have a voiced, oral, spread, or unrounded, fricative, alveolar. Okay. It doesn't put the symbol next to it, I think. But just to get an idea of what actually happens in your mouth when you produce those sounds. Now, there are many, many more sounds. Well, many, many. There are quite a few more sounds that are used in languages of the world. And as I said, we only have covered the ones for English and only the basics. But I want to say that there are, of course, also dialects which we could call, which we could say contain exotic sounds. Okay. And I would like to give you an example of this, and that is what we find in the dialect spoken in Liverpool. I don't know whether you've ever heard anyone speaking Scouse, which is the name which is used for the dialect spoken in Liverpool. And they've got, it's really quite something different from, you find it very difficult to understand, and I'll play something to you in a minute. One of the special things in, or special aspects of Scouse is that syllable final K becomes fricative. Okay. So they will not talk about sharks, they will talk about sharks. Okay. Or they will not say weak, but they will say wee. By the way, why and why is this different? Why is one and the other one sh? Think about, yeah? So you think all the people in Liverpool do a German course first before they? What's the reason? Yeah, but what's the reason why we say Woche and not Woche? There's a good reason for this. Think about the yeah.
Maybe because the
Think about the position of the tongue when E is produced and when O is produced, or A. Okay. And that's got to do with, because the position of the tongue is also important for the fricative. So the tongue would actually have to move quite dramatically if it was supposed to be Schach rather than Schach. Yeah. So that's, so basically the... It's not individual sounds, but they belong together also. I mean, their place of articulation and manner of articulation is related to each other, yes? Why? Yes. Yeah. Yes, this is something I'm actually going to come to now, because Professor Stubbs's pronunciation doesn't really change anything in terms of meaning, right? The why and the why basically is the same thing. Okay, all right. It's related to what I'm going to say next. So if you wait a bit, and if it's not clear yet, then we can come back to that at the end of the lecture. Okay, it's not. Yeah, I'll see whether I'll answer your question, but only partially. But we can talk about that later. Okay. I'd like to play you a little bit of Scouse, just to give you an impression of what it sounds like. Heard of Jamie Carragher, football player, Liverpool? Listen to him. All right? Okay. Shall I play it again? Notice that he says quicker, but he doesn't say quicker, but he says quicker. And he also, at the end of that little extract, he says back, but he doesn't say back, he said bach. Okay, I'll just play this again. I'll play this again. Yes. Right? So. Yeah. Yes, as I said, exotic sounds exist in English as well, and the Liverpool accent is quite different from received pronunciation as we know it. If you want to find out more about, it's not 100% certain yet, but let's say 99% certain, Kevin Watson, the same Kevin Watson as I mentioned before, he's actually a specialist on Liverpool English. He wrote his PhD about this. He's going to most likely be here on the 2nd of February, that's a Wednesday in the afternoon, and he's going to give a lecture about Liverpool English, phonetics, phonology, and beyond. So that's something, I will announce that again in the lecture. Oh yes, another thing that I forgot, this doesn't fit here at all now, this was one of the announcements that I wanted to make at the beginning. I mentioned the questionnaire which I said if you feel like, if you're a native speaker of German and feel like filling it in online, then I'm going to let you know where this can be done. I put it into the new section of StudIP. I will also put it somewhere and maybe even write an email to everyone. So if you haven't found it yet, it's there, but you'll be told about it again. Okay. So let's get back to phonetics. And that is partly an answer, I think, or it goes in the same direction, although it's not entirely true. Okay. But anyway, if we have the two sounds in spit and pit, or in this order, pit and spit, can you think of anything that's different. We can agree that both of them are plosives, both of them are voiceless, both of them are bilabial. But is there anything that's different? Do you pronounce the two P's in exactly the same fashion? You can try it out. Come on, spit at your neighbor. Spit. Okay. Now, yeah? Yeah, more like a B-Y. I mean, more like a B would suggest that it's voiced. But is it really... It's not... There is something, and it makes it... Well, soft is... Okay, one way... Yeah, but there is something... can you put your hand in front of your mouth while saying those two words? Spit and... Okay. Now, in one case, you will actually feel the air being, coming out of your mouth much more forcefully. Yeah. In the case of pit, there is an action that you can feel the air stream. But if you do this with spit, then this is much, much less the case. Yeah. If you want to try it out again. Okay. This has got to do with aspiration. Okay. We have some kind of little H thingy, okay, after P. It doesn't mean that it changes the word in the sense, I mean, whether I say pit or, yeah, I mean, you get into the area where you would want it to be bit because it's different, okay, but it's not meaning differentiating, it depends on the connection on where it is produced, on where it is produced in the word. One is syllable initial, and the other one is not syllable initial. There is another consonant produced in front of it. Okay. Now, can you find the word, and I've basically already given you the answer, where p and p create a change in meaning? I don't think you can. Okay. Can you create, can you find a word where exchanging the sound b for v creates a change in meaning? Well, that's pretty easy. Bet versus vet, for example. What we have here is a minimal pair. Only one sound is changed. Et is the same, the two sounds, but we once have a plosive and the other time not. It is not a plosive. Now in English, and this is very important, in English, p with the aspiration and p fulfill, we could call it the same function. Okay. And b and v don't fulfill the same function. Is this true for all languages? Can you think of a language where b and v are, yes? Spanish, yes. Speakers of Spanish have, what is the city? Valencia or Valencia or somewhere in the middle or... If a Spanish person says, I have a lot of problems with my, vowels, then it might actually turn out to be lots of problems with the vowels. Okay? Because in Spanish, there is no word where if you exchange one for the other, it turns into a different word in Spanish. Okay. So, or in other words, in Spanish the sounds b and v cannot be used to create a minimal pair. Any students of Spanish here? Can you confirm that? Thank you. Okay. Well, you always, as I said, phonetics and phonology is not my main field of research. Okay. What we say in linguistics or in phonetics and phonology, you may have wondered why phonetics and phonology. Phonetics is concerned with the study of the sounds in general. Phonology is concerned with the study of sounds, that language-related sounds. Okay. We are talking about those two sounds being part of the same phoneme. Mm-hmm. The sound itself would be the phone, and we talk about the phoneme. Okay. Another typical and very cliché-like example is the fact that Chinese aren't supposed to know the difference between l and r, right? Okay. That's also, and I know too little about Chinese to, any students of or speakers of Chinese here? Yeah. Are there words in Chinese where l and r make a meaningful, well, make a minimal pair? Okay, yeah. So it may be maybe because of a different, it's a different reason in that sense. But, I mean, with Spanish, I'm absolutely sure they have, in a way, both sounds, but they're just not meaningfully distinctive when it comes to minimal pair. So the sounds we will call phones, and they are language independent. And different phones can be used for the same function in a particular language. Yeah. So, p with an a aspiration and, well, okay, well, I made the point already. Okay. And if this is the case, then we talk about a phoneme. And the phoneme, which is in fact actually something relatively theoretical. You don't see a phoneme. You don't hear a phoneme. You always hear a realization of a phoneme. This is an important concept, that the phoneme is something theoretical and that is sort of a language-specific construct which you then only see realizations of, and it will become again important when we do morphology and other aspects of the description of language, because that's actually something that we see on several levels. Okay. So, you don't see a phoneme, it's something that can be realized in different ways. It is language-dependent, and p and p are realizations of the phoneme, of the same phoneme. In fact, we will call them allophones. Okay. Allophones. Now, when you do phonetic transcription, when you produce the sounds that are language independent, that could occur in any language and it doesn't matter in which it is, we're describing the sound in terms of place of articulation, manner of articulation, etc., then we use square brackets to describe the phones or to write down the phones. When we have phonemic transcription, when we describe when we transcribe something that is related to a particular language, namely English, for example, in our case, then we put we don't use square brackets, but we use those slashes. So if we look at this, we've got a sort of detailed description of the sounds in English, namely an aspirated P versus a non-aspirated P. And this is the phonetic transcription. But because the distinction between aspiration and not aspirated does not make, that does not change anything, does not create a minimal pair, we can also transcribe this phonemically. Okay. And then suddenly the two P's are the same. They are not the same in terms of the way they are produced, the way they are realized, but they are the same in the system that is English. And that's why when you read in Finnegan, you will see the title, if I remember correctly, Sounds in the Mind. Because it's actually something that we Well, for the Spanish person who has to learn the distinction between be and ve in German or in English, this is very, very difficult because somehow it just doesn't exist, this distinction. Okay. Of course it exists from a phonetic point of view, but not from a phonemic point of view. And as I've already said, the aspirated version and the p without aspiration, well, the p, I just produced an aspirated p, the p, no, it's difficult to produce a p without aspiration unless it is integrated into, well, other sounds around it, are allophones of the same phoneme. Later on, when we do morphology, we will be talking about allomorphs of the same morpheme. Okay. And, well, there are no allolexes, but we will talk about different word forms of the same lexeme. Okay. So this is an important concept, which I hope I've got across to you. Just to give you another example of allophones, how can you produce this word in English? Well, you can produce it with a with a t, right? Okay. Or you can produce it with a glottal stop. Okay. So in that sense, you can say that those two sounds in phonetic terms are allophones of the phoneme t. And if you transcribe my son saying water bottle, okay, then that would be with a t, phonemically. Okay. Next lecture, you'll get more. Okay. More on phonology. Okay. So we've done the phonetics bit, but I will tell you more about how different allophones are realized to produce the same phones, etc. Phonemes. Okay. We will also have a quick look. Don't run away yet, please. We will have a look at syllables and their structure, and we will look at what happens when we actually speak in connected speech, because what we've done so far is look at individual sounds, and we've already seen that it depends really on how individual sounds, well, what sounds follow in succession, and in fact we will see that connected speech is still running away. Connected speech is quite different in the way certain words are produced. Okay. Right. See you next Friday.